Welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Tyler Smith.
I am David Bax.
And thank you for listening, David.
I always listen. You're welcome.
How are you?
I'm good.
Okay. Okay, so we've got stuff to get to.
Yeah.
But I don't know what order we should go in.
I think the first thing I want to do is I want to hear your... You have a story you wanted to share.
Okay.
I think that's where we should start.
I have a story, but it's rooted in other things right now. That I needed to say. There's some serious things and then this less serious thing.
Okay.
That felt very serious at the time. So I have said on the show that I deal with depression and stuff, and the last 2 years have been particularly bad. Listeners of More Than One Lesson can attest to that because I've been very personal on there. But in the last probably 6 to 7 weeks, I've genuinely felt myself getting better. Like there's that phrase of like, oh, like, well, we're not out of the woods yet. I now find myself understanding the concept of out of the woods, mm-hmm. that I feel like I'm emerging from a very dark place, and I'm better able to handle rough emotional situations. Today I posted the new More Than One Lesson minisode, and I had accidentally uploaded last week's minisode.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, and I realized that while I was out at a grocery store, and like literally like 8 or 9 months ago, I had a similar situation, and I was in the car, and all I did was scream at myself for 5 straight minutes, mm-hmm. and completely freak out. This time I was like, oh shoot, better get home and then I'll take care of it.
Yeah, there
like,
you go. That's great.
It was that sort of thing. So I've been feeling pretty good. Here's the problem, David.
Okay.
When I am feeling good, and this is, by the way, something that I have to work through in therapy. When I am feeling good, I get more confident in myself.
Oh, okay.
And then I start to worry that I'm becoming obnoxious to other people. Because as my therapist says, when I get confident, like overconfident, it results in what he refers to as defiance. So this is where we will come to my story. So I just finished working for this this organization that I won't give the name of, but they're great. I really like them. My bosses are super awesome, and it's a program that I think I just like in general as an idea. It's part of this thing that referred to as study tours, where kids from other countries will go to a place, in this case for like 2 weeks. They will learn something about that place while also going on tours of that place. So here, kids would come here for 2 weeks, and for one of those weeks, they would learn about the industry of Los Angeles, which is to say filmmaking, okay. While also touring various places in Los Angeles. And so I taught 3 separate batches of those kids. And the third batch is when I guess like a bunch of kids came in, like my classroom went from 5 in batch 2 to 25. Mm. And that was, and I was only one of 3 teachers. So batch number 3 was like 80 kids spread out over 3 classrooms. And it meant that the kids were more closely monitored by all the kids are from Italy,
mm-hmm.
by some of their instructors who came over as well.
Okay.
So the day came when we had to watch Zootopia. That was part of the curriculum,
mm-hmm.
part of the pre-approved curriculum, by the way. That's important. And so we started watching it, and and one of these supervisors, who has no actual authority over me, by the way,
okay.
came into the room, got my attention, called me out while the movie's going on, and pulled me into the hallway and was saying, this is unacceptable. Like, for this, so this is session number 5. Sessions 1 through 4 are just me lecturing about film history. Session 5 is watching Zootopia, and then 6 through 10 is all group work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so this woman was very upset that that they weren't working in groups, that they weren't talking with each other. And I said, like, well, if you give it to the end of the movie, we're going to have a group discussion about the movie. And then for the entire rest of the class, it's all group work. And she's like, it's just like the kids, they're just falling asleep. And it's like, what are you talking? They're not falling asleep. I'm in the class with them. They're right there. I see them. And so she was just like really, really like upset at the idea of the kids just sitting and
watching
listening,
a movie?
Or like either listening to me or watching a movie. But the movie, I think, was the last straw for her. And so I said, like, well, this was part of the curriculum that you approved.
Yeah.
And so she said, like, she's like, well, they're just sitting and watching a movie. I was like, well, it is a film class.
Yeah.
And so here's where the confidence, uh-huh. because before I probably would have just like been like, no, okay, I'll see if there's something I can do. Now it's like, well, it is a film class and you did approve the curriculum. Now it's moving into defiance because now she brings in another person and now both of them are coming at me and saying like, this is not acceptable. The families are going to, their parents are going to get so mad at us. And I was like, it's part of the curriculum. What do you want me to do? And so finally, one of them said like, well, can you at least like just watch segments of the film and then talk about it and then watch another segment of the film? And I said, well, that's not exactly the way the filmmakers planned it, is it? Uh-huh. I was like, that's not the way it was intended. It's like, this is a film class. We should at least watch one film in its entirety. I've been watching clips and trailers for the last several days trying to get my point across. This is one entire film. And it's like, but you could talk about the characters. Like, and where do the characters go? Emotionally. And it's just like, and in my mind, I'm like, you need to calm down. Uh-huh. And so, but I was right, of course.
You were right.
And thankfully,
although I know this isn't the point. Why did you spend five sessions or four sessions on film history and then Zootopia, which is the culmination of all of film history? I don't understand why Zootopia.
So it's film history, not mere film history and also the way that society and culture impacts film and the way film impacts culture and society. So I did not pick Zootopia. I wrote the first four sessions and then someone wrote the last six. But Zootopia it's this idea. It's like, it's a mainstream film that the kids are probably familiar with, but it's, and so it's taking something that they saw when they were younger and saying, yes, but look at how much deeper you can
now,
look.
How old are now these kids?
They're high school age.
And Zootopia is what, 2 years old?
2 years old. And so like some of my kids were 14 and so they were 12.
That seems to me like that the doldrums, the valley, and when you're not watching kid movies like
when they're
Zootopia.
Tweens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're too old for that shit and you're not old enough to like.
The first session I threw Zootopia out and we watched United 93. Okay.
Yeah.
That was me making a choice. But these kids actually seemed excited at Zootopia, excited to because they had all seen it. Excited to re-examine, having now learned about film history, and excited to read more into it. And so,
I don't understand what this lady's problem was.
I don't either. And literally, I was like, "Ma'am," It's like I haven't called someone "ma'am" since I worked at Blockbuster.
Uh-huh.
But I was like, "Ma'am, we really are at this point only arguing about an hour and 15 minutes because after that." For the next several days, in fact, it's group work. And she's like, well, this is it's a communications course. And that's right. This was another thing I said. She's like, it's a communications course. She's like, it's called film and communication. I was like, what? What was that first part?
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're asking for it.
I was asking for it. Thankfully, my boss, that's the problem, is that my bosses live in New York.
Huh.
And so I'm the representative here, and so like it's going to come down on me. My bosses were not having any of this, and so they backed me up 100%, which is great. And suddenly, I looked like the good cop.
Yeah.
So I wanted to lead up that like this is the potential downside of me feeling good about myself.
Yeah.
And so like, I don't know.
Man, I don't understand what this woman's idea of school is.
Here's the little, the postscript.
Uh-huh.
The kids are picking up on what's going on. Okay. And so.
Do they like this lady? I'll find out.
During the break, a lot of kids went to the bathroom, and there are like four kids left in the classroom. Kids that weren't remarkably talkative when I would ask them questions and stuff like that. And they came up, all four of them came up and said, like, "I'm so sorry about our teacher." And they said, like, "We want to keep watching the movie. We want to." And it's like, I'm enjoying it so much more now. And and they said that. I was like, all right. Now, part of me is like, man, it's just a kid wants to watch a movie instead of listen to me. But no. And then afterwards, like, all the kids banded together and they said, like, it's like, and you know, they've got rather thick accents, so it's kind of adorable. Uh-huh. But they're like, "We paid for this, not them." Uh-huh. "We paid for this, and this, and whatever you want to do is what we want to do." And so I was like, all right, I like this little show of support. And then one guy said, I'm going to assume ironically, he said, "Power to the people." So yeah, well, it was a really fun experience, but I thought you would appreciate, because definitely. You know, you're kind of punk rock. Uh-huh. And
I still am. Or maybe I never was. I don't know. No, I'm very punk. That's my official. The official David Party line is that I'm still very punk. I definitely wouldn't have stood for that.
There were moments when I was surprised. Like I was saying, it was like I was having a debate with like a fellow student in school, and it's like, that's not the situation. I am an adult. They're in a professional capacity, just as they are. We're talking across purposes, and I need to be. Now, admittedly, they kept interrupting me, which isn't great, but I needed to tone it down, be confident without being defiant. So, David and listeners, it is up to you to let me know when I'm getting overly defiant as we talk about movies or politics or whatever in the future.
All right. Well, I'm no shrinking violet. I'm not exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, stand idly by. Speaking of power to the people.
Indeed.
One of the people who listens to this podcast sent us a gift. Now, we don't say this on every episode because we're not narcissists, but if you want to send us gifts, you can find our P.O. Box website on the our P.O. Box address on the website under About Us. Is that what it's?
Yes.
Under? Yeah. So we're always up for gifts. We especially like, or at least I, David, especially like candies from foreign exotic lands.
Yes.
I'm going to go on a limb and say that's a little bit of what we have here.
Partially because the packing slip says that.
yeah.
It says also, candy from exotic lands.
Yeah. You got to declare this shit.
Yeah.
No, this is from our friend Matthew.
Yes.
From New Zealand.
Yeah. Who I had the pleasure of meeting many years ago when I was visiting.
So thank
very
you,
nice man.
Matthew, for, oh, he's got a whole note that I'm not going to read because it's a little bit long.
I won't read it aloud. But, I'll just take a look at it here.
Yeah, he sent us some stuff. I don't know if he says what's for who, but the main point is he sent us some Tim Tams.
Which is good because I'm kind of hungry.
We got four things of Tim Tam. That's two each. So these will last the weekend for me.
They might last the episode.
I'm not going to eat any right now.
I'm going to eat this one. Oh, they're a little bit melty, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, it's been super hot lately. Okay, so. All right, so he sent us some Blu-rays. Oh, there's three of them. We're going to have to fight.
Oh, boy.
Over one. Well, I already have the Royal Tenenbaums on Blu-ray.
All right.
Do you?
I believe I have it on DVD.
Well, now you have it on Blu-ray, it looks like. And then we've got The Fisher King and Diabolique.
Okay. I've seen all three of these. Have you?
Yes, I have. Okay. I have the Diabolique DVD. I don't have the Blu-ray. And I don't have
any. Now you do.
Okay. And then, I don't know, do you want The Fisher King?
Sure.
All right. You got all The Fisher King. Very excited.
Thanks, Matt.
Very excited. Thank you so much, Matt. Yeah.
I prefer, I don't remember if he prefers Matthew. That looks like Matthew to me. Yeah. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
That's super awesome.
So again,
these Tim Tams are delicious.
Yeah. The P.O. Box address is on the website. Feel free to send us anything, especially candies from foreign lands, especially if they are cherry ripes.
Or just Tim Tam.
Which is, yeah. Yeah, I think when it comes to that area of the world, the Australia and New Zealand, the region 4 DVD area.
Yeah.
We both like both, but I think Tyler's more of a Tim Tam guy and I'm more of a Cherry Ripe guy. Thank you so much. All right. So let's pay some bills, huh?
Indeed.
I should have waited till you swallowed your Tim Tam.
Sorry. All right. So this episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated online cinema that brings its members a handpicked selection of the best independent, international, and classic films. Every day, Mubi's curators introduce a new title, and you have 30 days to watch it. That means that there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy, all for only $8.99 a month. Plus, when you use their mobile apps, you can download films to watch offline. Currently available on Mubi are the first three films by Francois Ozon. Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ozon?
I don't know how you say it, but yeah, I'm a big fan of him.
These include the film Sitcom, the film Criminal Lovers, and Water Drops on Burning Rock. So I was looking up Sitcom specifically because the title intrigued me. And here's what it's about.
Okay.
In Sitcom, a family lives in peaceful harmony until the father brings home a pet rat. Already we're yeah. headed down a good path. As each family member comes into contact with the rat, one by one they quickly go to pieces and their hidden sexual and psychological perversions are exposed. Now, David, I know what you're thinking. Sexual and psychological perversions, that's not the Ozone I know. But yes, that sounds really fascinating to me, that this rat just shows up and throws everything off. But anyway, so that film is called Sitcom, and it is just one of the films available on Mubi right now. There are 29 others, and there is also a special offer for listeners of Battleship Pretension. You can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com, that's MUBI.com/battleship to redeem now, or go to BattleshipPretension.com and click on the Mubi ad on the left-hand side.
And I would like to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great and they sound great. I know because I use them every day, so does Tyler. Today I was listening to the new Robin song, Missing You. New music from Robin. That's fun. And
yesterday you saw great. Christopher Robin.
Yesterday I saw Christopher Robin. Today I was like, gotta wash that out of my brain. Listen to some Robin. Sounded great. Sounded fantastic on my TweakedAudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at TweakedAudio.com, but if you use the offer code PRETENTION at checkout, you get 1/3 off that already low, low price and no shipping charges. So go to TweakedAudio.com and use the offer code PRETENTION.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Tyler?
Yes?
Let's get into it, shall we?
All right.
This was your idea, but we're turning it in. This is a bit of an experiment, maybe, possibly.
Yeah.
This might be something that we're going to do more of. What I want to call, I'm not sure if you had come up with a name for it.
Mm-mm.
I wanted to call it our Milestones series.
Mm.
So today, we'll be talking about milestones in film history, specifically in the field of editing.
Yes.
And so I think I've already like kind of made some notes for future versions. Cinematography, we could do a 5-hour long episode. It's a big one. I had to break that
this
up into
is
two parts.
Be, editing is pretty rough too. Like I had to narrow this down significantly.
But I also realized we could do a great one on special effects.
Sure.
I did a lot of, found a lot of research there. I would like to do one on women in specifically women in Hollywood or African-Americans in Hollywood. That would be a great series. Found some.
I would like to do one on makeup.
Yeah, I thought of a lot for a lot of the, and I found a few makeup, a few production design, a couple of stunts.
That
would be cool. Today we are starting, if this goes well, this will be a series that we'll revisit at irregular intervals.
Yeah. It's on the bubble right now.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to start with editing.
So here's where this started. I'll say this.
Okay.
Having to design a curriculum that will last 12 hours, because each of these sessions for this class that I did was 3 hours long. And you have to cover, 1890 to present. You know, 12 hours is a long time. But not really, as it turns out. when you're trying to cover that much, and you're trying to teach, the history of film, but also talk about, specific theories. Not that cinematography is a theory, but, along the way you want to talk about, well, what is editing and what does that mean? What is cinematography and what does that mean? Stuff like that. Genre theory and, trying to incorporate this other stuff into it. But it got me thinking about, okay, so if I had to boil it down, and this is something you and I talked about over text as another possible idea, if I had to boil it down to if I wanted to teach somebody what film is, not teach somebody how to make a film, but just what it is, and I only had movies to go with, no textbooks or anything like that, which movies would I choose? And so we arrived at this milestone idea, splitting it up into different categories. And so I did not necessarily limit myself to any specific number.
No, not at all. And I didn't limit myself to movies that I've seen.
I did limit myself to that.
Cause I went and did research on let's start, 1901.
Okay.
Short film, The Story of a Crime, is the first film to, edit, or to use a dissolve transition. 1901. That's
all right.
That's a big deal. It's also apparently the first film to use flashback.
Oh, okay.
And this is, by the way, I got this from a website that I'm not forgetting the name. Oh my gosh. I'll find it and I'll get back to you because I want to give them credit because I found all these somewhere. But I forgot to write it down. So yeah, there's other things.
I mean, definitely, I have. A lot of the ones that I have, especially from the silent era, are what you would expect. First off, it's not even a film, but I'd say just the Kuleshov effect. Watch that. It's something that I've shown, that I show my classes. I showed it at the International Christian Film Festival this year, because it's such a fat. That is what editing is. Take these two things, put them together,
and
we will make a story out of it.
I mean, that idea was there, but the Kuleshov effect itself is 1920.
Yeah.
So there's more stuff here you've got that I want to just mention, because I found this interesting. 1904, The Moonshiner, first film to use narrative titles or inner titles.
Hmm.
That's kind of editing related, right?
Yeah.
And then in the 1910s, that sort of... here's one that's not actually editing, but I'm really surprised this happened this way. 1909, D.W. Griffith's A Corner in Wheat is quote unquote the first use of freeze frame. Except it's not a freeze frame. The actors all just stood still, which to me, the fact that happened before we invented the actual freeze frame is hilarious to me. As just human beings, we knew we wanted movies to be able to do that, but we hadn't figured it out yet. So
what's funny is
actors stand still.
They stood still, giving each other a high five at the end of a really awesome thing, and then the credits roll.
Yeah, but that's what the Police Squad episodes would always do. You remember that?
That's right.
And then before that, you've got. I don't want to get too into this because obviously it's a problematic title, but The Birth of a Nation is not for editing, but for a lot of film techniques, sort of D.W. Griffith, or as we talked about on the Movie Journal, Lois Weber. Maybe we should go back and use Lois Weber as an example more often of surprisingly advanced editing and filmmaking techniques.
Well, using
things that basically in terms of cinematography, which we're not talking about, getting rid of the proscenium idea and actually using POV shots and cutting back and forth and over the shoulder shot and stuff like that, cross cutting, action scenes, flashbacks, all this stuff. Birth of a Nation is, again, not a movie that I have ever seen.
Yeah.
All of, or would recommend people watch all of. You can just watch Intolerance instead.
Well, I was gonna jump to Intolerance. Yeah, I mean, obviously, Birth of a Nation revolutionized a lot of stuff, and but Intolerance, people often think about Intolerance sort of in relation to Birth of a Nation. Like it's usually what you just did. Like the AFI did it. Uh-huh. Birth of a Nation was on their first top 100. Intolerance was on the second one, and Birth of a Nation nowhere to be found. And so we tend to look at it as the antidote to it. But of course there's a lot going on in Intolerance anyway. And from an editing standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint, and the idea of just having to keep so many different eras, straight without the use of conventional dialogue.
It's the Cloud Atlas of its day.
I actually have Cloud Atlas on here.
Oh, okay. I should have thought about that.
But it's really complex, and it's something that could be seen as confusing. And I actually think it's rather admirable of Griffith to decide, no, this is the way the movie needs to be told.
Yeah.
Even though he definitely would run the risk of confusing audiences.
And then, okay, so we mentioned it, but let's go, for those who might not know, back to the Kuleshov effect.
Sure.
And what this idea, or what the actual root of it is, which was that Lev Kuleshov basically took a shot of an actor looking at something off screen.
Yeah.
It's the same shot every time.
Yeah. And then specifically said, don't react to anything.
Yeah.
He's just not even looking at anything in particular. Just off frame.
And then cut it with him looking at different things, a baby, I think a hard boiled egg at one point.
It's a bowl of soup.
A bowl of soup.
It's a baby in a coffin.
Oh,
the baby is dead. And a woman on a, on a chaise lounge or something like that, looking very lascivious.
Oh, okay. So, and then he would show it to people, the different ones, and say, ask them what they thought of the actor's performance, and they would say, oh, he seemed hungry, he seemed sad, he seemed horny, I guess.
Yeah, they all thought he was a very good actor and was conveying these things. They'd watch them all separately, and it takes this idea that our brains want to make sense of things. We will look for patterns, we will look for themes, and if we find anything, we will seize upon it. And so it's here's a guy, here's a thing, I'm now going to relate these two things, and in doing so I will now read more into both shots. These two things were probably not in the same room, probably not shot on the same day, and certainly were not meant to be seen in context of each other, but our brain contextualizes things. We want to make sense of things, and so the Kuleshov effect shows just how powerful, how big of a role we play in telling the story. And that an argument, I don't know if this, if I don't think Kuleshov necessarily says this, but this idea that filmmakers, it's not that they don't have to work hard, but they realize the audience can be a collaborator. They can suggest things and we will fill in the rest. The Kuleshov effect is a really fascinating idea to me, and one that seemed inevitable, someone just trying to boil editing down to its basics and juxtaposing shots and having us make sense of them.
FilmSite was the name of the website that I got these from.
FilmSite?
FilmSite.
C-I-T-E?
No, S-I-T-E.
Okay.
Which
is weird, because you are citing it.
Yes, that's what I'm doing. So now what's interesting, so this is, it seems all the great advancements in editing were made by the Soviets, right?
Kind of, yeah.
Because you've
it's
got,
weird, isn't it?
You've got the Kuleshov effect, and then we'll jump to 1925, right? And
yeah.
The Battleship Potemkin, namesake of this show. Recently, the guy at the UPS counter, I had to go to a UPS to pick up a package. Mm-hmm. It was that Grisha's Palace Blu-ray that I watched a few weeks ago. And the guy at UPS was, because the package had Battleship Potemkin on it, and he was like, wait, is that a reference to, and then like, yeah, we talked about old movies a little bit, and it was cool.
Nice.
The Battleship Potemkin.
I would have had a business card in that guy's hand so fast.
Yeah, I don't carry them. So I guess it's almost subconsciously tempting to draw a direct line from the Kuleshov effect to the Battleship Potemkin, which uses the montage effect.
Yeah.
Which now we think of a montage as a more specific thing, like usually set to music. But it is sort of the same idea. Montage is a series of short shots, and it mostly it's kind of elliptical in the sense that it condenses time.
Yeah,
a lot of the time
when we think of montages now, we think of a long period of time. There's the concept of like the training montage, it brings together like probably months, whereas this, an argument could be made that, like, for example, the Odessa step sequence, which is like the most notable part of it, an argument could be made that that's happening in real time. The sequence does go on for a while, but also not. Like, it's that's what's interesting about like Soviet montage, is that it's taking a lot. It's taking this all in these separate things and putting them all together into this one unified idea and this one unified thing. It could be these separate time periods, or it could be these separate little stories inside this much larger event.
Yeah, and even before the Odessa steps, I mean, obviously that's the most famous.
That's
and
the one,
like most people our age, I saw The Untouchables before I saw Battleship Potemkin. But even before that, when you're getting to know the ship, you know, you're seeing, it is the same thing. It's a bunch of different stories, a bunch of different men in different conditions, and you're getting the whole, it's kind of, I guess, impressionistic. You're getting the impression of the whole, the whole thing. At once. And so what's interesting is that is not, obviously the Kuleshov effect has an effect on all editing, but there's not, that's not a one to one, or that's not an A to B. Do you know what I mean? Because it's the Kuleshov effect, I guess, describes something more literal, is that I relate this image to this image.
Right.
You know what I mean? And what montage does, it makes it more almost abstract or metaphysical in a way, like you're relating all these things, but not literally to one another, but all in a holistic way.
In a way, it's you're experiencing them. Now, of course, you experience everything, but when it comes to montage, it's almost like the shots are so short and everything's so packed together, it's not really giving you time to intellectualize anything. It's almost all pure feeling. And it probably, I don't know if it's meant to put you in the same mindset as the people on screen, but it's definitely meant to pull you in as much as possible. Which is why, you know, montage that's even modern, I mean, when you look at like an action sequence, I mean, that's montage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's meant to leave you breathless and not. And yes, you can think while you're doing it, you can think while you're watching it, but it's not really meant to play on your intellectual. It's meant to play on the instinctive, I think.
Yes. Yeah. But also, and this is jumping way ahead, but it's also something that couldn't have. In a way, you almost, I'm not sure you could have done it right away. You needed, at this point, over 25 years of cinema.
Yes.
Because you needed audiences to grow. You know, I remember, the reason I think about this is back in film school, I remember, and this is like, you know, sophomore year undergrad film school. This is pretty basic stuff, but it's like sometimes these, one of the great things about going to film school is, as after having watched movies your whole life, is realizing that you knew things that you didn't know.
Yeah.
And so one of them that I remember about editing was a shot from, or a sequence from Thelma and Louise, which is the part before the inciting incident where Gina Davis is almost raped and they kill the guy. They're at the club and then Gina Davis like leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there's these cuts where it's like, okay, she's closer to the door than she was in the previous cut. Now she's all the way out in the parking lot. It's elliptical editing that would have been confusing to someone when movies were first made. Like, how is she jumping through time or whatever? But we know enough about movies to know to just sort of fill in the blank of, she walked across the dance floor. We don't need to see every second of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
In watching some of the early movies, even stuff like, you know, A Trip to the Moon or The Great Train Robbery, which move at a pretty good pace. Well, the idea of the insert shot was not around yet. So you just had these like one camera set up and we're watching the whole scene. If the filmmakers had thought to cut to a close up of a gun or, someone pointing a gun or whatever it is, then they actually could have cut out some of the action and we would have made that, we would have filled in the blanks ourselves, but that wasn't a thing yet. The insert shot. And so, whereas, you know, an argument could be made like with Soviet montage, it's all insert shots, but.
Well, we'll get to, I want to make a quick stop before we continue with the Soviets. In 1928, 9 years later, almost 20 years later, 19 years later, they figured out the freeze frame. The first known example of a freeze frame is in an Alfred Hitchcock silent movie called Champagne, which ends with the thing we've all seen where it's a bunch of people like dancing and then it freezes and then it pulls out and you realize it's like a framed picture. But it was a moving picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's apparently how Champagne ends. And that's the first freeze frame, or at least the first one people cite.
Incidentally, real quick, I should say that over at my other website, More Than One Lesson, my writer Reed has been spending the year watching every Hitchcock movie.
Right.
Like from the beginning. Yeah. And he's still in the early stages, and it's astonishing how many movies Hitchcock made that we just don't talk about.
Yeah.
And so like,
and also how many of them survived, because there's so many movies from the era that he was making movies didn't survive.
And it's not like he was called an important director at that time.
But there's only like one big Hitchcock feature, I think, that is lost. I think I can't remember exactly, but
So if you're interested in like early Hitchcock, head on over to More Than One Lesson and go searching for it.
Okay, so 1929, we've got Ziga Vertov's The Man with the Movie Camera, which is pure montage. It is
100%.
Probably not the first experimental film, but it's probably the earliest experimental film that I have seen, in that it's not trying to get across a narrative in any way, but or at least a dramatic narrative.
Certainly
there is
not
a narrative in the sort of more meta way that we use the word narrative now.
Yeah.
I think there is a narrative that is imparting about the city or whatever, you know.
Yeah. The film definitely just it's full of energy, and it just seems like an absolute celebration of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of fun and crazy in a lot of ways. It is astonishing to me that like on the most recent Sight and Sound list, which at this point is 6 years ago, Man with the Movie Camera is like in the top 10,
mm-hmm.
which is, I don't necessarily think that's an oversight, but I guess when people say pure cinema, I guess what they're talking about. It's just something that like, narrative, I guess, whatever, who gives a shit? Well, look at this camera shot.
Yeah.
So the way that you're structuring this, so we're going on, are we going to go back
if we need to?
Okay.
I mean, I'm going chronologically, okay. But we both have our hands on the wheel here, so you can go back if you want.
Okay. I just and that's the thing, we're hitting a lot of the same things, but I did want to go back because you mentioned experimentation. I would say Sherlock Jr. Buster Keaton was fascinated with the camera. He was fascinated with anything technological, really. But with most of his movies, the editing was very, very sophisticated, but fairly run of the mill, until you get to Sherlock Jr. and you realize that he's really pushing the boundary and is willing to sacrifice a traditional laugh for maybe a more absurd laugh. So there's an extended sequence in which, I guess you could say, it's, I don't think it's the first version of this, but it certainly is a fun experiment in like match on action, where Buster is on screen. He jumps into an actual movie theater, movie screen, and so he's on a, you know, he's in a movie location, and he stays there, and then the location will change, and he will suddenly have an effect. Like, he's going to, like, he's going to dive into the ocean, but then just as he jumps, the ocean turns into, like, a big snowy mountain, and he just lands right into right in a snowbank. And it's just this, and it, you know... That one of the things that, you know, when you watch it, you realize, so he jumped into a movie. What movie is this that they're just showing one scene, one, you know, nature scene after another with no actual story? But that's not the point. The point is just he's able to do this and he gets to do it. And it's a dream sequence, so it's fine. And it's a really fun sequence that is. Like I was saying with Man with the Movie Camera, it's a guy who clearly is in love with filmmaking and is just excited that he's doing it. And I got a lot of that from Keaton. And I'd say all of Sherlock Jr. is that. And that sequence especially.
You mentioned action movies before as being montage. And I think of... I don't know what people consider the first action movie. I feel like the 20s is where action movies... Because that's where you get the Douglas Fairbanks.
Sure.
Swordplay movies, but also I think Steamboat Bill Jr., which is 1928, I think of that as an early action movie. And then the General is definitely an action movie.
Yeah,
that's 1930. Just, what year is
General? I think is 26.
Oh, it's before Steamboat Bill Jr.
I think so. I might.
Why did
wrong
I think it
that.
Was after? Probably because I saw it after. That's how dumb I am.
What an interesting world.
Yeah. No, you're right. 1926.
Okay.
But I feel like this was like 10 years ago. You like introduced me to the world of Buster Keaton. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we watched a bunch of shit and it culminated in The General. So sure. I tend to think of The General as being like later.
I think it is seen as maybe his most ambitious film, either that or Steamboat Bill Jr. As far as like logistics. But again, as far as filmmaking and experimentation, it's Sherlock Jr.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think people mostly say The General is his best film. But I think Steamboat Bill Jr. is your favorite.
It's my favorite of his, yeah. I haven't seen... There's some big ones I haven't seen. I haven't seen The Navigator.
The Navigator is very good.
And then there's Cameraman. Is that one of them?
I've not seen Cameraman.
Okay, but that is him, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So there's a couple of big ones I've missed out on. I recently watched Seven Chances for the first time. That's got great stuff in it. It's nowhere near the peak of his... I'm ready to start jumping forward, by the way. Because my next thing is in the 40s.
Yeah, my next thing is in the 60s.
Okay, so the 40s, and this isn't really editing so much. It's just a part of editing that I want to talk about was the idea of re-editing, and I want to mention The Magnificent Ambersons, and the idea that... and this sounds very Film School 101, I guess, but the idea that a director can direct a whole movie, but it can still be taken away from them in editing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's illustrative of how crucial editing is that, you know, Orson Welles directed the whole ass movie, right?
Yeah.
But because it was recut starting at a certain point, I think, you're the Welles aficionado at the table. There is, because he even recognized like there's a certain like after this point it's no longer my movie. I can't remember exactly.
I don't remember what it was. I read it in the second Simon Callow biography of him, but I don't remember what it is.
And I still think The Magnificent Ambersons is fantastic, but yeah, the first half is better. So this isn't a milestone in editing history. It's more of a very the sort of sad underbelly of what editing can do.
Yeah.
That you can take the thing
Well, and also it also speaks to the idea that a movie is genuinely made in the editing room. Like I was going to point out the entire career, specifically the latter day career of Terrence Malick, and the fact that he's cutting out entire characters played by notable actors, incidentally.
Yeah,
but that, you know, he clearly just shoots and shoots and has an idea in mind and probably has an actual script, but I'm sure for him, I don't know if he would ever put it this way, the movie doesn't start coming together until he starts editing it.
Well, do you know that this is an analogy I learned in film school. You probably did too, but compare making a movie to making a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So you writing a screenplay is writing out your shopping list.
Yeah.
Shooting the movie is going to the grocery store and getting all the ingredients.
Yeah.
Editing is where you're actually making the dish.
Yeah.
That's the analogy I learned that I think is, it carries over 1-to-1.
And I think it carries over even more so because you can't just take all the ingredients and throw them together into a bowl. You have to measure them out just right. Sometimes you have to add them in a specific order, you know? So like editing isn't just, all right, we've got all the stuff here. Everything's been shot. We have the script here. So obviously we know what order it needs to go in. So there you go.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
There are decisions that need to be made in the moment where you realize, oh, this shot works so much better precisely because it deviates from the script, you know? And like, well, there are a few things like in the original script for Jaws, not unlike the book, Hooper dies. Hmm. He dies in the cage. But then they got this wonderful footage of a real life shark getting all wrapped up in an empty cage.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh shoot, how can we need to use this obviously. So what can we do? And so they move some things around, and yes, it required some reshoots. So it's not something that they realized much later, but that was like an editing decision. And that was, well, it was a number of decisions, but you know, the willingness to sort of play it by ear often in the editing room. And if you know, our friend Wes Anthony could also talk about like the role that editing and music, like the relationship they have, that if music isn't working, if sound design isn't working, then like you can just discard it and do something completely new in the editing room.
Yeah,
that was rambling, sorry.
No, that's what I wanted to get at. Now, you said you had something in the 60s, but I want to stop off.
Okay.
I guess, and this isn't a particularly year, just sort of the late 50s is where the French New Wave comes into play. And that is a newish style of editing that breaks a lot of rules intentionally, mostly with jump cuts.
Right.
I mean, that's... that was my early sort of juvenile or not juvenile, but untrained idea of what the new wave was. Because it was just like, oh, that's like crime movies and they smoke cigarettes, but with jump cuts. That was kind of my idea.
As if to say, it's like, we don't have the budget for dissolves.
I don't know how, in depth we need to get it. Do we need to define what a jump cut is?
I don't think so, but I feel like maybe in the spirit of what we're trying to do, maybe we should.
Yeah. So, I don't think maybe there is a specific like degree of angle change at which it stops being a jump cut. But the idea is if you cut either closer or further away or just jump through time and you're still roughly at the same angle as the previous shot.
Yeah.
That's a jump cut. It's weird. It doesn't feel right. And sometimes it's, when it's employed, it's because it doesn't feel right. It's on purpose. It also has a lot. I mean, this gets into the 180-degree line, which is an idea. The idea that there is a line drawn somewhere through the center of every scene, and the camera needs to stay on one side of it.
Yeah.
And you'll see in some places where the 180-degree line is broken, like in The Birds, which you talked about in the movie journal. Mm-hmm. There's a thing where Tippi Hedren is watching the flames go across the puddle of gas and how
Albert speaking Hitchcock, of experimental editing, I feel like that's that moment. But I don't think it's that effective.
I don't think it works is the problem.
Yeah.
Whereas, if you look at something like, I don't know why this leaps to mind, but, The Bourne Identity, the first, and I'm sure the Paul Greengrass ones use plenty of 180 degree line breaks, but I remember when they get back to his Jason Bourne's apartment and they're like trying to figure out who he is, and the crazy guy comes to the window and Jason Bourne stabs him in the hand. Do you remember that?
Yes.
That whole thing. So after that, when it's just like Jason and Franca Potente, I can't remember her character's name, just sort of like recovering together, there's a number of 180 degree jumps, I think, sort of to get you in the headspace of how discombobulated they are.
I was watching the first like real conversation between between Batman and the Joker in the Dark Knight in the interrogation room, and there is a very clear 180 jump. And it comes when Joker, like, unsurprisingly, it comes when Joker starts taking control. Even though we don't yet know how much control he actually has, he's just taking control of the conversation. Like, you know, Batman, like, bashed his head against the table, and he definitely seems to have the upper hand, but then Joker simply by talking changes the general mood and gets Batman's attention, and that's when there's a now the camera's always kind of moving, so but as the camera's moving, it never moves across the 180 degree. There's an actual cut.
Another going back to film school, a little clip that I saw at this point, I had not even yet seen The Lady from Shanghai, but the Hall of Mirrors sequence in The Lady, Lady from Shanghai. I had to watch it again to see my professor's right. My professor's contention was that Orson Welles doesn't actually break the 180 degree rule because the characters keep switching which side they're standing on. The line moves and the camera moves with it. So the camera keeps being on different sides of them, but it's because they're switching sides, and it's actually kind of a dance that the camera is doing with the 180 degree line with the characters.
That's about right.
It's
I haven't seen that movie in too long.
It's been a couple of years for me. It's a good movie.
So
I'm sure you hadn't forgotten that it's a good movie.
Thumbs up.
Also 1959, before we get into the 60s, is William Wyler's Ben-Hur.
I was going to say Ben-Hur.
Oh, well, I thought you said the 60s.
And you know what? And I remember that in the shower, it's like, no, I got to bring up Ben-Hur, obviously. But I forgot to write it down. But yeah, I was going to say Ben-Hur just now.
Okay. I mean, we talked about action sequences. I've never even seen the movie, but I've seen
it. It's a really, really great movie. And I mean, the chariots sequence, like, you know, in talking about, you know, Potemkin, people talk about the Odessa steps and people talk about the chariot race in Ben-Hur, and understandably so. It is, you were talking in the movie journal about like spectacle, I mean the bigness of that chariot race, and just it's in many ways it's very conventional editing as we know it now, but it's just like, we need to show Ben-Hur, his enemy. We need to see specific spectators. We need to see what lap they're on. We need to see what the horses are doing. We need to be reminded that how big the crowd is. Like, there's so much that we need to capture about this sequence. And just, again, there's a rhythm to it. And that's not something that's not found in the script. The script just describes what happens in the chariot race. Like, everything about this, William Wyler obviously has to like cover the hell out of it. But like, and there needs to be a very specific rhythm. Like, we need to know, like, we've stayed on Ben-Hur too long. We need to now see where they are in the race and how they're doing. Like, it is a beautifully realized sequence. And again, the movie is very good. And that sequence is marvelous.
What is this? Breathless is 1960. I guess we already talked about the French New Wave. This is when I talk about thinking that French New Wave was just crime movies with jump cuts. I'm thinking of Breathless.
Yes, which is, of course.
Probably the first French New Wave movie that I saw. I probably saw it when I was in high school on VHS.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't see Breathless until I lived here, actually.
In Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And then I would have seen Shoot the Piano Player after that. I'm not sure what else came after that. But then in 1961, you've got what I think is one of the greatest films ever made, and a movie that you hated the first time you saw it, Alain René's Last Year at Marion Bad.
Well, let's stay in 1960 for a moment.
Oh, okay.
Because one thing that, you know, we're talking about the different role that editing can play, but in Psycho, okay, editing and the literal cuts, mm-hmm, in the shower scene actually act as cuts.
Yeah.
Like, the idea is, you know, in a way you could say, like, oh, well, we're cutting away just as the knife is, like, penetrating, yeah, the skin.
Did you see 7852?
No, not yet. Yeah. I just saw that it's on Hulu, and I was like, oh, yeah, and I'm excited to watch
it. It's worth watching. There's only one shot where you can actually see the knife touching her skin.
Yeah.
In the entire...
Yeah, and it just kind of slides across her stomach, right?
No, it's... I think he actually did it in reverse, where he took, like, the dull knife and, like, just not actually, didn't actually cut her, right, but, like, put it into her belly a little bit and then pulled it out. Yeah. So then, and then
the shot is in reverse. It's fine. I'm doing it in reverse. Like, you're still cutting me, Alfred.
Yeah. And it's not Janet Leigh. It's a body double who was interviewed extensively in 1752.
I have no doubt. Yeah. And so, so that's an instance where, you know, we talk about, you know, a POV camera. Well, there's not really a lot of POV editing, but I feel like the closest we could come is the shower scene in Psycho, because every cut is a cut.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
It's not merely a means to cover something, a means to get away from something. It actually is. Every edit is an actual stand-in for a physical thing that is happening.
And then, yeah, Last Year at Marion Bad, again, directed by Alain René.
I don't like this at all.
I'm trying. We got an email, this is like a couple months ago now, about how Americans don't know how to pronounce French names. And so I've been trying to make more of an effort to learn the correct way. And that French R, where there's kind of an H in there somewhere, is kind of fun to do. So Alain René.
René.
I like René. It. Anyway, Last Year at Marion Bad couldn't be more different in its feel than the shower scene.
Yeah.
Because this is another, I guess it's like montage, except montage tends to compress time. Last Year at Marion Bad either elongates time or kind of obliterates the concept of time.
Yeah.
Which is something that I like about all of René's movies. Particularly Hiroshima Mon Amour, which might actually be my favorite of his movies, but also Je T'aime, Je T'aime and Muriel. You lose yourself in them because he doesn't. He's not really concerned with, you know, the pacing making sense in terms of real life pacing. The movie does have its own cadence and it lulls you into it, but it's there's no telling how much time is passing, and that's intentional.
Yeah, it's always interesting when movies try to emulate the way our brain works, not utilize the way our brain works. It tries to actually simulate it, you know, and you get stuff like Mulholland Drive and specifically when it's trying to show like how memory works or how dreams work. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's going to be this fluidity to it. And yeah. In a dream, and I would even say in memory, of course, memory is related to time, but when we're thinking about the memory, we're not thinking about time, really. It's not happening, it's not happening in real time. We don't have memories in real time, just like with dreams. And so, yeah, just this very languid pacing for Last Year at Marion Bad is something that speaks to another point that I was going to make about editing a little bit later, but it certainly applies to this, is that knowing when not to cut or when to like draw something out and is just as important a choice as cutting like, oh no, we've gone on too long.
That reminds me of something that I had put on the list. We skipped over it, which I'm fine with, but another 1959 movie called Compulsion, another Orson Welles, Orson Welles vehicle. Not he didn't direct it, which has,
I'm sure he had some opinions.
Yeah. But it has like the longest true monologue in film history, at least up to that point, where he talks for 10 minutes straight. And I think that's the kind of thing where, you know, when we're talking about montage, talking about action movies, talk about Alain René, we're talking about editing that kind of calls attention to itself.
Yeah.
But to have a character talk for 10 minutes, and it remain interesting, that's kind of a feat of editing too, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes that's, I won't notice editing while I'm watching a movie, but then, we talked about, you and I both recently just saw Christopher Robin. Mm-hmm. Neither one of us thought it was that good, but I did at the end go, that was 2 hours? Like, it does move.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a good way of sort of judging good editing, is if a movie doesn't get bogged down.
And not that we're talking about Christopher Robin right now, but like, because we already did, but one thing that I did get a sense of is, and I think this is on purpose, time, even though the character, like, he's got the weekend and all that sort of thing, like, he is very aware of time, like, in the Hundred Acre Wood, and also just, and it starts to infiltrate his life itself, is that, like, time starts to not mean quite so much, and right. From a it's something I started thinking about in terms of structure. Like, the film is not structured in any kind of traditional way, and so it that actually allowed us to spend time just getting to know Pooh, and then not mm-hmm. quite knowing where the crisis is going to be. Except, oh, it's already there. It's his work crisis. Like, but surely that can't be the crisis, right? Like, the way it's structured actually helps to undercut the character's like priorities.
Right.
I don't mean to give the movie more credit than it's due, but no, it's, you know.
I mean, I want to give Mark Forster credit for trying
sure.
to make a good movie. I don't think Mark Forster's a hack. I think I tend not to like his movies
right.
that much, or not to love them at least, but I do think he's an auteur of sorts. Anyway.
Of sorts.
1963? Is that...
I think the next one for me is 66.
Okay, so 1963 is another movie that I saw fairly recently this year, Tom Jones.
Sure.
And this is a movie that is all about the editing. It seems like it's kind of... It couldn't feel less like a Terrence Malick film, but in yeah. terms of the way it's made, it kind of seems like they had the screenplay, they went out and shot it every which way, and then Tony Richardson came back and really, really made the movie that we know in editing, because it's full of freeze frames and wipes and all sorts of jumps, and like everything about that movie that makes it so lively and so funny is in the editing, I think. It's if Terrence Malick made comedies, maybe?
Yeah, it's... oh, boy. Wow, what would that be like? I guess it'd be like that.
I wonder what Terrence Malick finds funny. Do you know what I mean?
There is a Twitter account, and it's like fake Terrence Malick, uh-huh. and he just says like the most inane, stupid, fratty bullshit.
Yeah,
which is like, that's really funny to picture. But yes, that's a good question.
Yeah, I don't see him that way. I like to imagine Terrence Malick getting a big kick out of the Family Circus. that's who I imagine Terrence Malick.
See,
is.
I could see, yeah,
and I would kind of like
looking
that.
At little Billy like meandering around, and he's like, "That's how I'm going to make my movies."
Uh-huh.
Just you know, wandering around the living room.
Yeah, that's true.
So.
All right, so you had 66?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's 66. I think Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is 66, right?
Okay.
Okay.
So
I was showing the final sequence in class, but what's interesting is I was showing it to talk about camera shots, but it's also edited in such a specific way. You know, speaking of, like, it's very languid, and mm-hmm. and the cameras, you know, the camera starts very wide, and then it gets closer and closer, and then it actually boils everything down to the only three things that matter in a gunfight: hands, eyes, guns.
Mm-hmm.
And we just go back and forth, checking in with every character, seeing their hands, their gun, their eyes, all that sort of thing. And then finally, you know, and then the editing gets faster and faster and faster as it goes. But one thing that occurred to me is that, I mean, of course, none of these things, we can devote an episode to editing, we can devote an episode to cinematography and makeup or any of these other things, but none of them exist in a vacuum. You know, you still need the right camera shots, which is why that last sequence between, you know, Clint Eastwood and Eli Wallach and Lee Van Cleef is why it's so beautifully realized is because it's shot in just the right way. Like we know every, it's like what I was talking about with Ben-Hur, except I think the editing here plays a more vital role of getting us slowly but surely more. It speeds up a little bit more, and now we're just cutting only to close-ups. Mm-hmm. But that to me, and then of course there's the music, which I'll talk about the interaction of music and editing in a moment, but all of
we
these
should
things,
do one of these on sound. I don't know if I said that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That was our big, to me, that was the big takeaway from Columbia. Like there was such an emphasis on sound.
Right. Yeah. Columbia there. College, Chicago is where we went to undergrad film school. I only went to undergrad film school, but now we have to specify undergrad because you are a master of film.
I'm only a master of cinema and media studies. All right. Not all of film, just the study of cinema and media, all media, by the way. I was going to make a political joke, but I don't have the energy.
Good.
But yeah, and so it's the... So when you talk about editing, you're probably going to wind up talking about cinematography as well, and just the way that you really can't have one without the other.
Obviously, yeah.
So, anyway. Okay.
Okay. 1969, nice.
Okay.
Staying in the Western genre, we've got Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch.
Okay.
And I feel like I didn't realize this when I put together my list here, but we keep coming back to action movies. And it seems like a lot of our sort of like leaps forward in editing are leaps forward in action cinema. And The Wild Bunch does kind of represent a milestone in action cinema in that it's... incredibly violent.
Oh yes.
And it's a movie that at almost 50 years old next year, right?
Yeah.
Still feels incredibly violent.
Oh yes. Clearly Sam Peckinpah looked at Bonnie and Clyde and said, "Oh, you're just going to kill two people, huh?"
Yeah.
All right. We can do better than that.
He said that scene, but a whole movie.
Yeah.
That's what he wanted.
He's like, not enough scorpions
and
ants. And everybody looks too cool and calm. We need to make it nice and sweaty and super gross. I actually do want to go back to 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Okay.
Which is 68.
68, yeah. It's the 50th anniversary of this year.
That's right, yeah. And that, you know, obviously there's one... I'll bring this up along with Lawrence of Arabia. There are these two.
The match cut. In Lawrence of Arabia, it's a literal match cut.
And then with 2001, the ape throws the bone, and then it cuts to, you know, thousands of years later.
Yeah.
And it looks like a spaceship.
We talked in the Movie Journal about how I recently watched Paul and Pressburger's A Canterbury Tale for the first time. Mm-hmm. That has one of those, too, because it has a prologue in the 1300s with, like, the pilgrims traveling to Canterbury. Mm-hmm. And one of them, like, sets off, like, a messenger pigeon. Mm-hmm. And then it cuts to a warplane flying over over England that matches with the pigeon. It's great.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah. And that predates both of the examples you just
All right.
By decades.
Kubrick and Lean hacks.
Yeah. ripped off Michael Powell.
That might be true, actually.
I feel like pretty much every director has been ripping off Michael Powell since
That's about right.
Since the 70s, probably.
But then there's also...
greatness borrows, genius steals. That's the saying.
Yeah, I feel like that's not a legal defense, though. You can still lose a lot of money if you say that in front of a judge. Anyway,
okay.
In 2001, when there's a really wonderful sequence when the ape first gets hold of the bone and is very slowly figuring out that I can use this to, you know, bash things heads in, and it's just, and so we see it just like hitting other bones on the ground, but it's cut with the actual, was it like a tapir or whatever it is, whatever that animal is.
Yeah.
Like we see that in between the ape like hitting stuff on the ground, we see these various tapirs like falling on the ground, and so it's like, oh, so it's cutting to where we're going to wind up eventually. Right. And then he throws the bone. So like, we don't actually see those scenes of them hunting them, using the bones. We just see little flashes of, okay, we all know where this is headed. And then, okay, we're now headed thousands of years in the future. And it's just it's an interesting choice, I think, where it's showing us like maybe a couple days in the future, but just flashes of it before making a huge jump.
Speaking of a huge jump, I don't have anything until 1993 now.
I will say that I think, I just wanted to write it down because I just wrote it down because I thought it was good, which is the French Connection. Mm-hmm. I think
the action,
yeah,
not an action movie, but an action sequence.
Yeah. And I do think that the chariot race in Ben-Hur could be seen as sort of a chase, but I do think that the chase scene is a very specific type of action sequence and one that needs to be edited very specifically. It needs to be shot very specifically, obviously, sure, because that's one where we always need to be going the same direction. Otherwise it's going to be very jarring. And then yes, being able to know where we're headed and what progress we've made. That's the other thing. Like, we need to know that we have moved forward, and that means knowing when to cut to the right thing at the right time, which is the thing that I'm going to say over and over again. I'll try not to say it that often, but that instinct of knowing when to do that is what makes the great editors great. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. So
1993.
Okay. What do you got?
Well, this is one, I've never even seen this movie.
Oh, okay.
But this is another little factoid,
okay,
that I learned. Lost in Yonkers, 1993.
I've seen it, yes.
You have seen it? Do you know what's notable about it from an editing standpoint?
No.
First feature film cut entirely on an Avid. So first really? Time a feature film was converted into digital and cut entirely on an Avid.
That's interesting. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah. Lost in Yonkers.
I love stuff like that where, like, there's always got to be something first or something last. For me, I think this is 93. It might be 92, but I think it's 93. I have Shortcuts. Okay. And I wanted to package a lot of these together. Shortcuts, Magnolia, Nashville, these kind of ensemble things. But I'll incorporate, you know, Avengers Infinity War into it. And even something like Crash, which won Best Editing. When we have a lot of characters, and you and I talked about this when we talked about Infinity War, but like when you have a lot of characters, if we spend too long with any one person, we actually start to forget that the other characters exist. Mm-hmm. And so there needs to be a very specific type of rhythm.
Yeah.
Which is interesting given how big of a role jazz plays in Shortcuts, how big a role music in general plays in Magnolia, like that John Bryan score, which is just which keeps things going. And then obviously Nashville is a very musical movie. Music doesn't serve as much of a transition from one edit to another, but it's interesting how often these types of movies that require us to really keep a lot of stuff in play, music tends to be something of a driving force behind the editing itself.
Yeah.
I would say The Hours also is an example. That cast is not very big, but there are several different time periods, and the Philip Glass score is used as a transition along with the editing to get us from one time period to the next.
And obviously you've already mentioned Cloud Atlas, which we're going to get into again. I feel like Infinity War, it is definitely part of this, but Infinity War pushes things. It works for me. I think the movie's very good, but we spend longer without characters in Infinity War than I think we do in any of the other things you mentioned.
Oh, undoubtedly, yes, yes. Because, Infinity War is also more plot-based than the other things that I'm talking about. And in that regard, Infinity War's, it probably should be compared more to, like, Lord of the Rings, where we have people in completely different parts of the world. Okay, we can move on.
97?
97. Hang on. What do you got?
I'm almost at the end of my list here, so I don't think.
Is it Sweet Hereafter?
No.
Damn it.
It's Star Wars, Star Wars trilogy, the original Star Wars trilogy being re-edited.
Yeah.
This is like a sort of mirror version of what I was talking about with The Magnificent Amherst since 1942. This is another thing where a movie that we all know unlike many of the cinema, since we never got to see it.
Yeah.
We all know these Star Wars movies, and then the director gets to come along and say, no, they weren't finished then. Now they're finished.
So it's the opposite of Orson Welles,
Where
he's like, no, I still have control 20 years later.
Yeah. And of course, George Lucas is not the only one to do this. Ridley Scott has recut Blade Runner a handful of times.
Still doing it.
Sure. Well, I don't know. That last one's called The Final Cut. I think he's done.
I'll believe it when I see it. When he's dead, I'll believe it.
You haven't seen it?
Speaking of being dead.
All right. Yeah, it's late at night.
So
anyway, I just wanted to mention this, the idea that a movie, I guess, I don't know that I necessarily love the idea, but it can be a living document that a filmmaker can go back and and tweak.
Because he's changed those movies even since then.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the Blu-ray release was different than the DVD release. Even as far as coloring. Like the I think the Blu-ray release of Star Wars has just the slightest bit of magenta hue to the whole thing. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't surprise me.
But I actually do want to go back and talk about something. The idea of taking. Okay, I'm not sure how I would even classify Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, though, right? It's taking pieces of footage from other movies, shooting Steve Martin in black and white, and splicing him into these other movies and making it into a, we'll put quotes around, coherent story. And it's something I don't see happening very often, probably because it doesn't make a great deal of sense. But yeah, that is if nothing else, it is definitely a feat of editing.
Yeah.
And then I guess there's also something like Hoop Dreams.
That's difficult for me to contemplate shooting for 8 years and then making a movie, even though the movie is 2 hours and 45 minutes long or whatever.
The movie is not 8 years long.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And speaking of, I guess, travesties of editing, to go back to movies that are very long and then not, Greed, which is like, neither have I, but I know that it was originally, 8 hours long?
Wow.
And they cut it down to like 90 minutes? No wonder Eric Von Stroheim went totally fucking insane.
Yeah.
But so something like Hoop Dreams, which was not nominated for documentary, but was nominated for editing. Because the editors, I'm sure they all just said, like, I don't know how you do this.
But also because the documentary process is weird. The nomination process is weird. I can't remember what it is, but I know
there's
always something that every year people are complaining that, that it's limiting.
I was listening back to, an old episode of Siskel and Ebert in which they were talking about, like, when they would talk about, like, their surprises of, like, Oscar inclusions and snubs, and they were so furious about Hoop Dreams not being nominated for documentary. And then they spelled out like what the nominating process looks like for the documentary branch. And it was interesting. I don't remember what they said, but it was, it definitely had its own rules at the time.
I only have one movie left. And that's 2002.
Okay. I have a 1999.
Okay, let's go.
I've got The Limey.
Oh yeah.
Speaking of movies about memory. But you don't realize that's what it is. I mean, we do have flashbacks, oddly enough, to an earlier Terrence Stamp movie called Poor Cow.
Mm-hmm.
But there are these, like, I wrote a paper about it when I did my undergrad.
I love it.
I hate having to say that now.
Oh, I love it.
But there are these sequences. There's one in particular. It happens throughout the movie, but there's one sequence in particular between Terrence Stamp and Leslie Ann Warren where they're having one conversation over three places, and it will cut to them in these different locations.
Mm-hmm.
But the conversation is linear.
Yeah.
The one line leading into another, that all makes perfect sense. But there's a moment when, like, Leslie Ann Warren says something and it cuts to Terrence Stamp, like his reaction, just a facial reaction in a completely different location. And then it will cut to his facial reaction in another location as well. And it's like, why are they doing it this way? It's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know eventually what it's going to be, it's a really fascinating way to make a movie. And at the end of the film, you cut to Terrence Stamp on an airplane going back home, and you realize that he's reflecting on his LA adventure.
His summer vacation.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, it's over so fast. Now I got to go buy like pencils and new pants.
Yeah.
But him thinking back on that is that it's almost like I was saying about memory before, like we think of the important parts of a memory, not all the little in between moments. And so what he remembers is these are the three places we went, and this was the important conversation we had. I don't exactly remember where it was, or this was the whole conversation boiled down to just the few minutes that that are important to me. And so, so it creates this very strange little sequence that makes complete sense narratively, and yet is almost I would say is experimental editorially.
So I know I've listened to the commentary. Did Soderbergh just shoot the full scene three times and then
find it
in editing? Yeah, that makes sense. All right. 2002, my last movie.
I have not 2001 A Space Odyssey. I heard that earlier, but I have something for the year 2001, which is Memento.
Okay.
I do think that that's a it's a well edited film. And I was actually just watching somebody, I think our friend of the show, Jason Eakin on Twitter, posted like a video of Christopher Nolan sketching out on like a whiteboard, like what the narrative looks like. And he just showed like this line that curves around, and he says, that's the narrative. And he goes, but right here is the present, here's the past, and we're going to cut back and forth between the two. And we will lead to this point here, which is actually not the end.
Mm-hmm.
It is an end, but it's not the end. And it is a very, like, I actually think that narratively it doesn't make that much sense, especially when dealing with memory loss. But structurally, it's really fascinating. And the idea that when you're not dealing with, when you can't remember things, then like I said, there really is no beginning to a story or an end to a story. There's just whatever end you happen to be at right now. And that, I think Memento does that very, very well. And the fact that you're able to keep track of it as well as you do. Yeah. But, okay. So I think that's it for me.
Okay. So 2002, I wanted to mention, you talked about, editing is also about not cutting.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to talk about Alexander Sekurov's Russian Ark, which is a 96-minute movie with no cuts in it.
Yeah.
I remember loving this movie when I saw it. And I feel like it's become trendy to hate the long take. Do you know what I mean? In movies.
Well, I didn't like long takes
before it was cool. Yeah. And I still, I mean, I've said plenty of times on the podcast, my rule of thumb is usually if I notice or I'm thinking about the long take while it's happening, then yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah,
I don't like,
off.
I don't like the one in, what's it called?
True Detective?
No, I like that one.
Children of Men.
No, I like
Atonement.
Most of those. Atonement is the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Dunkirk sequence in Atonement is one that seems real showy to me.
Yeah.
But I think as visual effects has made it easier to hide cuts, you're seeing more movies like in Children of Men. I don't know if all of those are actual full takes. Are they?
I think there's a hidden cut somewhere in there. I don't remember.
And I know there's a hidden, there's a part where the lens gets cleaned. I don't know if you were like,
yeah, that's true,
near the end when they're going through that whole like battle sequence at like the apartment building or whatever. I haven't seen it since the theater. So, but there is one point where like something gets splattered on the lens and it stays for a while and then it goes past something and conveniently like clean the lens. But then you're seeing stuff. I know a lot of people complained about this, but I loved last year. There's a fight sequence in Atomic Blonde that I didn't realize was until the next day when people were complaining about it, or the day it came out when people were complaining about it. I didn't realize it was an unbroken take, but of course it's not. It's many, many takes.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone, not just Charlize Theron, I don't think any stunt person could do everything that she does in that take without taking a break. I think it's, I like it when it's used. I like the lack of cutting when it's used well. If I feel like it's showing off, maybe I don't like it quite so much. But usually, I would say 9 out of 10 times, I don't notice. Like, the True Detective one, perfect example. It wasn't until I, God forbid, logged onto Twitter. I'm thinking about spending less time on Twitter, by
probably
the way.
A good call.
It wasn't until then that I realized people were either loving it or hating it.
Right.
I didn't even realize it was Unbroken at the time.
I don't think I like. I don't think I hate Unbroken takes. It's much the same thing as you. Like, if I notice it, it's like this is an Unbroken take. That's impressive. Are they counting on me thinking that right now?
Yeah.
Like I don't care for that. But there
a stupid Panic Room with the camera going through like the coffee mug handle. It's like,
you know, and there's a moment where like the camera kind of goes through, I think like a lock or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I might be thinking of something else, but in which case that at least fits thematically.
Right. Yeah.
Coffee mug handle. Come on.
Yeah. You're just showing off.
Yeah. But I will say there is one, Unbroken take. And I did write it down here, but there is one Unbroken take that I think is so effective, and the camera's not moving. It's just, they just chose when Steve McQueen made 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, okay.
There is a sequence where Chiwetel Ejiofor has been, I guess, lynched, but like the reason I say I guess is because they did not do it with the intention of killing him.
Right.
They did it with the intention of just like torturing and intimidating. And so I think that probably still counts, but it's a wide shot. He's fairly small in the frame and he's just hanging there. And basically as long as he's on his tiptoes, he's going to be okay. So you just see him standing there, and the sound design is vital here because you hear the squishing of his toes in the mud, and the camera just stays there. It's a static shot and it just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And I saw it at a critic screening, and that shot might be five. It's not 5 minutes. It's probably 1 minute, maybe even less. I don't know. But every few seconds, after a certain point, every few seconds, you would hear someone in the audience go, "Ugh." One of them was me, because, and I think what it was is every critic at that point needed there to be a cut, like. A cut closer, like not a different scene. It could be we could get closer or further away, whatever you want it to be. But that cut provides us with something of a break, even if it's unconscious. And we know that, oh, well, they probably put an Apple box up in between camera setups for Chiwetel Ejiofor. But this is just like a link between character, actor, and audience. And the choice to not cut is what allowed that.
I think my favorite version of that intentionally not cutting when the audience wants you to is in Funny Games. The aftermath of the first killing, I guess, that we see.
Yeah.
We're left in the room with the body for almost 10 minutes.
Yeah.
The camera does move. It pans, but it is an unbroken take. That's horrifying.
And
and Michael Haneke is loving it.
No question. And then there's a long take along those lines. It's not as clear cut as that, but at the end of The Lobster, speaking of critics making noises, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So right at the very end, it's going on, and the critic right next to me, she goes, "Fucking Christ!" it was something like that, but it was some variation of those words, and I was just. And I wasn't bothered because she was thinking what I was saying. I was thinking what she was saying. But obviously editing is a vital part of filmmaking. And certainly there are milestones that I'm sure we did not even get around to.
Yeah,
but
let us know.
But yeah, in the comments section, please let us know. And here's a fun thing. I know that Patton Oswalt has mentioned this before, but it was something that I was thinking about as I was writing this. Why is it that some of the most notable and successful film editors are women. Like, when we think of some of the best, there's like Walter Murch, yeah. but we think of like Thelma Schoonmaker. Is that how you say it?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's how I've said
And then like Sally Menke. And like, we saw Tarantino after with Hateful Eight, mm-hmm. which I think is a fairly well put together movie, but like, it certainly does not have the same pacing as his previous films.
Yeah. I know the widely told story is that editing in the early days started off as being seen as a woman's job because it was seen as similar to sewing. It's something that, you know, you need little fingers and dexterity,
yeah.
You know, because
that, and after because, a while you couldn't employ children to do it. So,
yeah. Cause then this is before the, epoch, the sea change that was lost in Yonkers. people were, you know, physically editing, you know, cutting and taping together a film. It was seen as being similar to sewing. That is the story that I've been
told. Okay. That's interesting.
So that's that. Let us know if you like this, and we'll do more of them.
Yeah. And feel free to suggest, any particular, episodes.
You can find us at battleshippretension.com. There's reviews this week of Christopher Robin and Nico 1988 and Never Going Back, reviewed by Scott. And you can email us at david@battleshippretention.com or tyler@battleshippretention.com. I'm on Twitter at Davey Pretension. Also, premium content. There's plenty of great stuff for you to pick up at our premium content store on the website. Mm-hmm. It supports the podcast and it gets you some more entertainment that you haven't heard on the regular feed here. And we're actually
fucking coming up on another. Sorry for swearing. It's getting late. We're coming up on another damn commentary. Like,
In maybe September, a month. Yeah, month we gotta find a time because I'm very busy in September, so we'll have to figure this out. You're on Twitter at Tyler Pretension. You also have another podcast called More Than One Lesson. Is there anything going on there right now?
Yeah, this week Josh and I did a minisode about Yasujiro Ozu's Tokyo Story, which is the 48th best film of all time according to the More Than One Lesson listeners. They did a vote, I guess it was like a year and a half ago. So we're doing a minisode series about each film. And so we've talked about The Princess Bride, Singing in the Rain, and now we're at Tokyo Story.
All right. So check out all that. And thank you for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.